welcome to pod 58 of the official Palace pod. I'm Chris Grissom from Palace TV, which you can watch on YouTube, the official Palace app, which you can download from the Google Play Store and the App Store, on eagles.cbfc.co.uk and on all our social media channels. I should just pre-record this bit, but I quite like doing it in a different order each time. It's quite exciting to mix things up. It's better than just sitting indoors talking to my dog. So on this episode of the podcast, we have an absolute club legend. It's Sir Steve Coppell. He's managed the club about 437 times over the years since the mid-1980s. I was chatting to him on Zoom, and it was his first ever Zoom call, so I am privileged. I was chatting to him about the 1990 FA Cup final on the 30th anniversary of that final, but we did cover just that whole era there of those amazing players and that amazing team. It was really great to talk to him. He was in fantastic spirits. So here is Sir Steve Coppell.
Have we got there?
Not there.
It's a difficult task for a man of a certain age, that's all I can say.
Have you not done many of these with family and friends yet?
No, I just phone up, old fashioned.
Ah, okay. No, this has been brilliant during lockdown.
Yeah. Well, I've seen on the telly, obviously, so much, so it's nice to actually take part. I feel as if I've made an advancement today now already.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So whereabouts are you?
Well, I'm in my house. I have a little office. Nice area. I'm jammed in between two golf courses, which I might even be able to play shortly.
Yeah, some good news this week.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you just been getting out for plenty of walks around there?
Yeah, I sort of spend my days just sort of, like most people, I suppose, doing emails and rubbish and... you know, just normal stuff in the morning. I'll go for a walk in the afternoons and then listen to the coronavirus report. I've become almost addicted to it because we're a part of social history, and it'll be fascinating to see how this will be portrayed in years to come, the decisions that have been made. And, you know, I find the whole experience, you know, just interesting, just very, very interesting.
What do you think about the possibility of football coming back behind closed doors?
I think it will come back. I think the Germans have got it right. I think everyone will be looking, obviously, at the Bundesliga to see what happens. But I do feel as if, you know, it's a good positive step when there's been, coming up to 8 weeks of negativity almost. And so bad news. So, you know, football is a drug to many people. So hopefully the drip feed will begin again in the not too distant future. But, you know, ever mindful of the consequences, obviously.
And people talk about home and away advantage. In an empty stadium, will you still get any kind of home advantage, or is it normally based mostly on the fans?
Oh, mostly on the fans and the atmosphere, the build-up, the atmosphere, the whole day experience, I think, more than anything. You know, it's as a player and as a manager, you do sense a huge difference for a home game and away game. So, you know, the whole experience, I think, more than just the fan appeal. You know, getting up in your most of the time in your own bed and being around familiar people, getting your routines or your superstitions, whichever way you like to look at them. I think it is obviously, and statistics prove it, it is a big advantage. So I can understand the misgivings of some of the teams who've got so much at stake. You know, thankfully, Palace, you know, they can be dragged in, but realistically, you would hope that they would never be dragged into. Any kind of problems. Thankfully, they're out of it. But possibly the chairman, you know, I think he's been terrific on the TV. The article he wrote in the Times a couple of weeks ago, I think he's been a voice of reason and very accepting of the fact that if it can't go ahead, then it can't go ahead. But I think the desire amongst too many people is for it to happen. I think it would be hugely beneficial for society psychologically.
So you mentioned, changing the subject slightly, you mentioned morning routines there. So it is 30 years to the day since the FA Cup final in 1990. So it's 10 past nine in the morning. What were you doing 30 years ago?
Well, usually, I'm an early bird. I get up early, and I would imagine, I know for a fact from memory that I was up early. I like to have my breakfast in almost isolation because your mind's ticking away. Any last-minute things you have to bring up and try and resolve. I liked having breakfast by myself. So that would have been an early breakfast, probably 7 o'clock, half past seven or something like that. And then I would just retire to my room and just make sure my routine and the things I had to do were 100% and ready to go. So that's what would have happened on the big day.
And I remember the FA Cup finals, how big a day it was on TV back then. Did anyone involved in the team watch any of the coverage like before you leave the hotel to go to the stadium?
Oh yeah, certainly for me the cup final was always a big day. You know, as a kid growing up, I remember getting up early in the morning and watching all the programs that sort of led up to the final, breakfast with the teams and all this business. And again, from memory, I think we did that. I think we had a camera crew there at the hotel. I always think that the cup final is a player's day. You know, it's very much about them wanting to embrace and enjoy the occasion, which is why, you know, I was very fortunate. I played in three finals, lost two of them, but won one of them. And, in those days, you would make the record, you'd do the suits, you'd do all the things that were accepted. And when we got to the final, I said to the players, I said, listen, I fully understand if you have a sort of players pool and you do the suits and the song and all that, and please, you know, do it, enjoy it. I said, but don't think you're going to make a great deal of money, because 18 months later, you'll get a tax bill and you'll end up thinking, well, I've wasted so much time chasing stuff for next to nothing. And that's exactly what happened. I think we had Eric Hall, the players had Eric Hall as their agent, and he was sort of shuffling around all day, trying to act as if he was in control of things. All of that was, looking back now, it's fun. You know, it's a fun thing to look back on, and the players doing the record, it was just... a fascinating thing to see them doing the things I had done so many years before. So, you know, it was really great as far as I was concerned to continue in that vein.
So the season leading up to that, how well had the team adapted to getting promoted into the top flight? It's a tough start.
Well, a very, very steep learning curve, obviously culminating in the 9-0. And then to go on from there. That, as I've said many times, that was the catalyst for change. You know, we suspected that we weren't going to be good enough, myself and Ron. And it was more or less confirmed in those early months. So we knew after the 9-0, like Ron was the driving force behind it. As a manager, in many ways, you give them what you've got and you get on with it. Whereas I'd always worked very, very closely with Ron from my first days at the club. We spent so much time together going up and down the country looking for players. And we discussed it so often and in minute detail, really, about what we needed. And I think if we could have got away without making changes, then we would have done, because we wanted to give the players a chance. But it was obvious after the 9-0, we had to change. We had to do something different. And like Ron was really good. We made significant signings, most notably was the first £1 million goalkeeper. You know, other signings we made just bulked up the squad, gave us a little bit more savvy, and made us more competitive. And, you know, that competitiveness was shown in the cup run we had, and also our improving form. And, it, you know, the indication of the semi-final was being beaten by Liverpool at home when, you know, I made a mistake. I'm the first to admit I made a terrible mistake, made a substitution while somebody was injured, and the injured player couldn't continue. So we played so many minutes with 10 men, my stupid mistake. But I think it showed to everybody that we were getting a hell of a lot closer. And as I say, our results were proving that we were capable of competing. And maybe not with the top teams, but certainly with the lower end and the middle table teams. So the improvement was significant as the season progressed. But, you know, to actually culminate in a cup final appearance was, you know, a testament to the hard work that everyone had undertaken.
Yeah, so many amazing stories with the players in the squad of how they got there. You mentioned Nigel Martin. I spoke to him yesterday. That the story of him is incredible. You wouldn't get it now. The Bristol Rovers tea lady spotting him playing for a local Cornish team, signed for Bristol Rovers. Then two years later, he's a £1 million goalkeeper. What was so good about him?
Well, it was one of those, as I said to you before, like myself and Ron used to go up and down the country looking at players. You know, the number of trips we made to Crewe, you know, to watch various players that we eventually signed, and, you know, a lot of games where we never signed anybody. And it was literally, you'd go down blind alley after blind alley, and then every so often you saw a pot of gold. And Jerry Francis was manager of Bristol Rovers at the time, and we used to go down there. Ron had known him from years back. I didn't really know him, but, you know, we went to Bristol quite a few times, and, you know, we're looking at this goalkeeper, and we're both thinking, he's good. This fella is really good. He was solid. He was quick off his line, his distribution, just his shot-stopping ability, his physicality. And, you know, when we decided to make the change, you know, we thought, right, let's do it. And to be fair to Bristol and Jerry, they pushed the price. We didn't really obviously want to pay that much money, but we both decided that it wasn't a gamble. You know, I've said this many times. You know, people have said to me, well, you must have been frightened almost of paying £1 million for a goalkeeper. And I said, well, as far as we were concerned, it wasn't a gamble. I thought he was blue chip. I thought, whatever happens, this fella will play well. He will make saves. He will contribute to us staying up. You know, and we've made a few inquiries about his personality. You know, he was and is very personable. And he came in. And again, you got to remember that, you know, in those days, we trained at Chelsea's old training ground down at Bishopsford Road, which is now Tooting and Mitcham. And you go in there and it was a wooden shack. And despite our best efforts, it wasn't the cleanest. It was run down. It was ropey. You weren't always guaranteed to have hot water after training. You know, our kit wasn't the best, our training kit. He came in, took it all in his stride. From memory, again, he lived in a little flat in the middle of Croydon. And what a shock that must have been for him. You know, his nickname was Blazy, because that's where he was from, Blazy in Cornwall. And, you know, to come and live in downtown Croydon, it must have been so hard for him and his wife, Amanda. And he just got on with it. And he was terrific. I think you earn your respect as a player. When you come in as a big signing, you know, people are looking. People want to see you, you know, deliver almost. And from day one, his personality was great. He delivered in training. And when we did doggies, little shuttle runs, he was probably one of our fastest players. And I always think if you're fast, then you have power. He had power. He had a great mentality. He was blue chip. Never, ever a gamble as far as myself and Ron were concerned.
And a player that you signed at the start of that season who'd already had a history of the club, Andy Gray, is such as when you look at his career path in the 80s, it's so strange. So he was at Palace as a youth player, wasn't he? And then played for non-league. And then you signed him and played up front. And then he moved back. And then he left the club, played for two different teams, and then came back again. What was what's the whole story with Andy Gray for you?
Well, he was just a live wire. He was, you know, there were so many things. The bottom line with Andy was he could get distracted. He could get diverted mentally. But as a player, when he was focused, he was a super player. He really was. And in many ways, you know, I look back at Andy's career and feel he underachieved with the ability and the capability he had. You know, again, he was another player that we'd taken from Dulwich originally. Billy Smith, who played a critical role in the development of the players that we brought in. Local non-league manager used to come into our training ground as often as his job allowed him. He'd have a cup of tea, we'd chat, very knowledgeable. You know, he was in charge of Dulwich when we first made our first signings, non-league signings, which were a necessity, not a direct option. We'd seen Andy play. Tony Finnegan came as a sort of make-weight. You know, the two of them were lively. They were good fun most of the time. Although Andy, you know, had his moments where he was, you know, a pain in the backside. You know, the famous story about him coming in for training. I made reference to the training kit, and you know, he'd come in and he'd always come in reasonably late, and he complained one day about not having sufficient training kit. And I said to him, listen, I couldn't care what you were as long as you're out there for 10:30. And he came out in a sheepskin coat, which, you know, looking back, it was typical of Andy. You know, he needed to make a statement. When he was focused and he needed to make a statement with his football, he was a terrific player. When he got diverted, which he did fairly regularly, as I say, he became a pain. But it was great to have him back because I always knew he was capable on a big stage of delivering. So, you know, he was a terrific story for us. And, you know, I still see him now occasionally round about and still good fun. Still, you know, still connected. I would say that about, you know, a lot of my players. You know, I feel even if I haven't seen them for 10 years, I'll see them and we start chatting as if we just come out the training ground at Mitcham and just, you know, shooting the breeze.
I guess he was quite a key part of the dressing room. It sounds like from the amount of players I've spoken to, it was a tough dressing room, wasn't it? How did you manage all those different characters?
I wouldn't say they self-managed, but almost self-managed. You know, we had deliberately after a while, we had the sort of non-league mentality. We wanted that abrasive quality that non-league players had of wanting to prove a point. You know, Arne Pardew was a case, probably the best case in point. He came in, I'd signed him for a Yeovil, I think, for 6,500. And he came in at 24 years of age. He was a glazier. And he came in and straight away you could tell he wanted to make an impact. Strong personality. Even at that time, you know, he knew this was an opportunity for him and he was determined to take that opportunity. And that's what he did. And he imposed himself, you know, when we went away on trips. I was always very keen on taking players away on trips because I felt it did bond them. We always had our pre-seasons in Sweden. We'd have, 10, 11, 12 days. We played 5 or 6 games. It was intense. But I also gave them a couple of nights out where they could let the hair down. And Alan very quickly came from a position, you know, a non-league player, 24. He came in and he was an important character within the dressing room. You know, he became the social secretary. He used to organise them when they used to go out at nights. And yet, his physicality was such when we did runs, you know, the old bleep tests. I think Alan Pardew still holds the record for certainly the players that we did the bleep test with. He was a terrific physical animal who could get up and down the pitch all day long. And, you know, you think at the start of our promotion season, our midfield was Andy Gray and Jeff Thomas, and they both got injured. And for the last half of the season, our midfield was Alan Pardew and Dave Madden. And they were fabulous. Great combination. Dave Madden, silky skills, good passer. Alan Pardew doing the donkey work and a far better player than a lot of people gave him credit for. You know, these kind of players played significant roles within the dressing room, and the leaders led. Jeff Thomas, just a good, solid northerner. You know, and I say that in the nicest possible sense. You know, he spoke common sense. He wasn't a shouter and a screamer, but when he said something, people listened. And, you know, the combination of the players we had, a few scatty ones, a few who didn't want to be leaders, and a few very happily accepted the leading role, gave for a good balance. It was a nice mix of ingredients that made them, the most important thing, made them all hungry.
Especially hungry, were bright and bright for goals. They were demanding on their teammates, weren't they? Especially the wingers.
Oh, yes. Yeah, 100%. You know, our game was built on get the ball out wide, get crosses in. And I always said, you know, having played at United, we played a variation of that style of play. And, you know, if you were out wide, you know, a centre forward, someone who's in the box, can time runs when he knows the ball's going to come in quick. When you get some wide players who go down the line, check back again, check back, pass to somebody else who then crosses. You know, your two centre forwards are making 3 or 4 runs, trying to anticipate the ball coming in. And, you know, we had very much the philosophy, if the ball's out wide and you can get the ball in the box as quick as you can, get it in there. Because we got 2 sticks of dynamite in the box. You know, they were both goal hungry. You know, as regards Mark Bright, I think we won a game once away at Birmingham, 6-0. And he came in, he hadn't scored, and he starts throwing his boots around the dressing room. You know, we'd won 6-0. In the words of my old coach, Dave Sexton, it was the perfect game. Win 6-0, 3-0 first half, 3-0 second half. It's the perfect game as far as he was concerned. And we'd had the perfect game, 6-0 away from home. So first time I'd done it, I was delighted. Come in the dressing room, Brighty's spitting, he's throwing his boots everywhere, he's complaining that someone didn't pass to him, didn't get across him. And Ian was exactly the same. You know, on occasion, if Eddie or John Sulaco never got the ball in early when they should have done, they knew about it. And the next time, they made sure they got the ball in quick. And that's why they scored goals consistently, because we gave them what they wanted.
How different was that team and that group of players to other teams that you played in as a player and also that you managed later on? Were they quite unique as a group?
Yeah, every player's got it. Every team, rather, has its, you know, a little things that make them totally different. But that gave, in many ways, gave me a blueprint for other teams that I wanted to play like. You know, you look now and you see certain teams play, Liverpool, Man City, what have you, they could be wearing like pink shirts, but after 5 minutes watching them, you'd know it's them because of the style of play they had. And we had a style of play, and it was very much, you know, it was built on, you know, basically what I'd learned at Man United. We were more direct, obviously, than Man United, but, you know, the philosophy was get the ball out wide, get the crosses in, play down the wide part of the pitch, and then deliver good quality ball into the box so that your strikers can score goals. It's the way we played at Manchester United, specifically under Tommy Doherty. And it's the way Tommy Doherty had played many, many years ago when he was a player at Preston with Tom Finney out wide. You know, it was very much that famous Preston team philosophy. Bill Shankly was a part of that. You know, you look at the Bill Shankly teams of years gone by with Ian Callaghan and Peter Thompson. Again, that was, as a boy, that's what I'd watched as a kid. Get the ball out wide, get crosses in, score goals. And, you know, that team created its own identity. Every team changes when a new piece in the jigsaw is added or taken away. But we had spent 5 years building that team to get promotion. You know, looking back now, I've said many times, if it was now, there's no way I'd have got 5 years to get promotion. I was lucky that I had the support and backing and, you know, friendship, I would say, of Ron Knowles as my boss. And again, the club was built on the fact that almost every day throughout the season, we would go and watch at least one game, possibly two. You know, so it would be training in the morning, meet Ron somewhere, go to a game in the afternoon, a reserve game somewhere, and then in the evening travel to watch another game. And the hours we spent in the car, you know, molded our thought processes as how we wanted the club to go, not only on the field, but off the field as well. And, you know, obviously it was a time of great progress for the club. And, you know, I like to think it gave me the blueprint for how to do things, you know, at other clubs I managed. It was a philosophy stolen from, you know, other people within the football industry, but a philosophy, I think, that was created in the 1930s at Preston.
But then fast forward to that, we'll go back to that final at Wembley. You mentioned the style of play. Did you have a, was there a specific game plan for Man United? Because I watched the full game back and you see you had Richard Shaw playing in kind of midfield on Neil Webb and then John Salako tracking Brian McClair. Was it very much geared towards them?
Well, again, the whole thing, the style of play in the semi-final and the final was formulated from the 9-0 defeat. Because, again, when we got to the first division, we thought, well, we've got promotion. We've earned our right to be here. Let's play teams. Let's use our style, which was get the ball out forward and wide and get crosses in. Let's use our style to compete against the best. It became obvious it was more of a struggle in the first division. And when we played Liverpool in the semi-final, you know, you look at the Liverpool team, the names in that team, the quality in that team. You know, I looked at it and I thought, well, if we have a go at them, you have an attack, we have an attack, we'll lose. We could play well against them and lose. So my number one objective in that game was to stop them playing. You know, and I thought, what's the best way of stopping them playing? So we more or less, to a certain extent, went man for man across the field. Now, that inevitably breaks down when somebody's out of position. But we more or less went man for man across the field. And I knew that my boys, when they had that definite plan, you know, that matchup, you're against him. Who's going to win that battle on the day? I just thought it would suit their mentality. So, you know, with the coaching staff, Alan Smith, Ian Bramford, again, a wonderful level-headed contribution. Alan, who was with me for a long, long time, again, part of the all my time at Crystal Palace, you know, we sort of got this plan going. We practiced it in training. We saw where it would break down. We saw where we could hurt them. And it worked against Liverpool. And then I'm thinking, well, Man United, man for man, are not as good as Liverpool. But, you know, if they play well, they're going to beat us. Brian Robson's, Mark Hughes's, all these players. If they play well, again, they're going to beat us. So we adapted the same plan, a man-for-man philosophy against Man United. And it almost worked, I think, is the best way of putting it. I think, like many things, the more you see something new, the more you can unsettle it. You know, people have a go at the second game about how we didn't play and we were more intent on the physicality. It's the biggest load of rubbish ever. You know, it was just maybe a bridge too far for us. And, you know, the goal against us was, you know, not a great goal as far as we were concerned. And it would have been, you know, fitting, I suppose, if that had gone to a nil-nil and we'd have tried again.
Did you consider starting Wrighty in the replay?
Well, again, but looking back now, it's probably my biggest regret. You know, again, the Liverpool plan was born out of the fact that he was injured. You know, we didn't have the players to play our normal style, so we adapted the players to play a different style. The first leg, the first game, you know, Ian was desperate to play, and, I had to make that hard, hard decision not to play him. And it was hard because I knew he had the ability to create something from nothing, as he did do when he came on. He was sensational. And then I had that conundrum in my mind. If Ian plays, we have to go 4-4-2. We have to go back to 4-4-2. It's a matchup. If United play well, they'll beat us. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, if we play well, you know, we've got a great chance of scoring goals. And because we'd played the man-for-man and the spare man at the back, you know, and again, Andy Thorne was terrific as that spare player, reading situations. You know, if he'd have been as part of a back four, would it have been as effective? We might have had more chance of scoring goals, but I could have seen them scoring as well fairly, you know, not easily, but they had more sort of weapons in their armory. And, you know, I toiled and toiled and I thought, well, we still have the situation where Ian physically isn't 100% fit. I think he'd only been training a few days before the first game. And then in between the matches, we didn't have a chance to train much at all. So his fitness was still a question mark. And in the end, to suit the greater good, I decided to stick the same way of playing, knowing that if things weren't going right, I could bring him on. But looking back now, I should have been bolder. You know, we had a great chance. It would have been a hell of a surprise if we'd have turned up and played 4-4-2 against them. You know, in the end, we just missed out. But it was still a couple of great nights, I think, for Palace fans.
And how proud were you that within a couple of years, so many of those players went on to play international football, even for England?
Well, it was fabulous for it. I think it justified what we'd done. You know, that the success of those players wasn't just 1 year's work, 2 years' work. It was 6, 7, 8 years' work. You know, when we come in, or when I came in, rather. You know, there was no money, myself and Ian Evans, you know, starting the process, realizing how big a job it was. And then, you know, that climbing the mountain of getting out of what is now the Championship, the second division, you know, everyone acknowledges how difficult it is to get out of that second tier. And again, it took us 5 years. We handpicked the players. We put so much time into seeing them that it was a justification for all that work that they then went on to achieve international status. So it was proud for me, you know, when they all got the call-ups. So I just felt, oh, that is just so good. You know, we worked hard on the training field, but we also worked hard in recruitment. And, you know, I still say now, people say to me, how do you be successful in football? And I say it's over 90% recruitment, getting the right players, the right pieces in the puzzle that is a winning football team.
Most recently, you've been managing abroad. You've been in India. What's it been like out there?
But a fascinating challenge, you know, just to explain in India, you know, various years I've been there. You get 7, 8. In my first year, we had 11 foreigners. You have 14, 15 Indian players. You have to play 6 Indians and a number of foreigners. And communication was a huge challenge because, you know, I thought mistakenly that they say 90% of Indians can speak English. 90% of Indian footballers don't speak English, I can guarantee that. And even some of the Indian players can't communicate well with each other because there are 30-odd main languages in India. And, you know, some of them couldn't communicate very well. You know, my last year in Kolkata, we had Spanish players, Brazilian players, African players. Again, the challenge of communicating how you wanted to play, the patterns of play, everything, you know, just having a team meeting was a challenge. So, you know, the whole thing, I did it the first year because I thought I would never get the chance to travel around India. And it was a starting project, I suppose, to have soccer competing against, not competing against cricket, but nothing will compete against cricket in India, but being part of the entertainment, sport and entertainment for TV audiences in India, I thought, what a great opportunity. So I did it 1 year and then asked back a second year and asked back a third year. So, you know, I feel as if I've done my time in India now, but it was a great experience, a great challenge, you know, and something I'm forever grateful that I had the chance to do.
I've seen you down the Palace training ground a few times over the past few years. What happens when you come down? You're just watching training sessions?
Well, just huge respect, I suppose. Not only for Ray Lewington, who I worked with many, many years in a number of places, but Roy. You know, I haven't competed against Roy and watched him work. You know, as I say, just huge respect. And I go along, everyone makes me very, very welcome, and I really appreciate that. You know, there is a suspicion, I suppose, in many clubs when, you know, different coaches turn up and what have you, but everyone at Palace makes me very, very welcome. And I just enjoy watching, you know, top craftsmen ply their trade. And, you know, I look at Roy and, you know, the way his team plays and the way it's set up, it's different from the way I would do things 100%. But I can really appreciate his knowledge and his expertise. And, you know, I find it fascinating to watch what he does on the training field then be translated into a performance. And, you know, his commitment to the way he does things and the way he plays, you know, huge respect and you know, appreciation of what he does, and that's reflected in the results the team have, you know, season after season since Roy's been there.
And finally, what's next for you? Did you have anything in the pipeline before all this happened?
And no, to be honest, you know, I feel I have the energy to work, but I realise that probably my wheel has turned, as it were. Football is all about, you know, that wheel turning, and you know, although there are quite a few people in football who are older than me, I think I'm seen as being, you know, of a certain era, and that era's probably passed. But you never know. I'd like to work somewhere. I really would like to work. I've got energy. I feel as if I've got something to contribute. But you're not in control in that in football. So, you know, I'm not really the type to sort of have an agent who pushes my name out there. I think if I did, then I would probably be in work. But, you know, I feel if anyone wants to employ me or wants, you know, just to chat with me, I've mentored or tried to help a few younger managers over recent years, which I've really enjoyed, and you know, long may that continue. But I would like to work, you know. I think this lockdown has proved to so many people how important football is in their lives. You know, I've always been of the opinion that I sort of take it or leave it, but there is something about the buzz of not only going to a live game, but the anticipation of watching a game on the TV at the weekend, you know, a big match, or just a match which, you know, tickles your taste buds for some reason. You know, you think, oh, that would be a great game to watch. You know, they play one way, they play another way. Who's going to come out on top? So all those things, I think we all value and appreciate now, the role professional sport, not just football, has in our lives. And you know, how big a hole there is now when it's not there. You know, we've all adapted and started doing different things and got different interests. But, you know, if a full league program were to start again, the Premier League matches, I think the audience figures would be really, really good. And I hope, certainly, that the Premier League finishes. I think the other leagues might have a few more problems. I think the Championship will finish as well, but one and two, I think financially the restrictions on completion might be a bit too much. But bring back the football, bring back Sunday afternoons, watching the top games and the top players perform, and hopefully we can get over this, all these restrictions, and get on top of this virus very, very quickly.
Exactly. Look, thank you very much, Steve. Really appreciate you taking time to chat about 1990, and hopefully in a few months' time see you at the training ground.
Yeah, I hope so too, and come on to Palace.